Okay, so we're going to be in Acts chapter 27. And Paul, at this point, just to quickly review where we're at, we're nearing the end of the book at this point, and actually this section goes fairly quickly. So we really only have a couple more classes left here in the book of Acts. Acts 26 ended with him saying, "I appeal to Caesar," and Festus didn't know what to say. Here's this man, he's been on trial, he's appealed to Caesar, which every Roman citizen had a right to do, but I don't know what to tell Caesar about this guy. What do I say? So he has this friend Agrippa there, and Herod Agrippa, he asked him, "You know a lot about the Jews," and the Herods, they did. So Paul spoke before him, and in the end, Herod Agrippa goes, "You know, if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, I think he would have just been set free." And so they're still left with that problem of, boy, what do we say about this guy? And the sense that you get as you go through Acts here is that the letter that they wrote, whatever it said, was favorable to Paul. And we say that for several different reasons. One, history tells us that Paul was let go in the end. So in other words, Paul went to Caesar, had his trial, and he's going to be set free. So that letter, I'm sure, would have helped if it was more of a positive nature. And then the other reason is the treatment that we see Paul receive at the hands of the centurion who's going to guard him on his trip to Rome. It's very favorable, very positive. He gets a lot of freedoms. Part of that will be the centurion seeing how Paul acts and seeing Paul's trustworthiness. But part of it is just the nature that Paul's been put in kind of a different category of prisoner, I guess you could say. He's not being put in the common prisons. He's more of a house arrest sort of circumstance. He's being given different privileges, all sorts of things that are different about Paul's situation than anybody else. And so chapter 27 leads us from Paul appealing to Caesar to now Paul making that trip to Rome. Now, if you go back and you remember, Paul had desired to go to Rome. He desired to make that journey that he's now going to make. Of course, his plans originally were not to go as a prisoner. It was to go as a free man, but he's going there nonetheless. As the crow flies, it's about a 1,400-mile journey. Paul did not go as the crow flies, though. So Paul was all over the place. It was well over 2,000 miles that he traversed by the time he was done. And most of it's going to be by boat. And so as we read through this chapter tonight, we'll kind of go along the journey. And I've got the map up here, and we'll follow Paul on his trip. But for the most part, a lot of this is straightforward. And after we cover Paul's journey here in chapter 27 all the way to the island of Malta, which is where chapter 27 stops, we'll go through it, and then there's just some interesting things, some pictures and whatnot that I'll show you at the end that are interesting from a Bible history standpoint about some of the things that happened, details that come out of this journey, because Luke was very specific in writing about Paul's journey. And so it gives us some specific details that we can compare to archaeology and secular history that are sometimes just kind of interest. So Paul's here in Caesarea, and this is here on the map. I have all of the different cities that he'll eventually travel to as he goes all the way up to Rome. As you look at the map, this chapter 27 will take us all the way to the island of Malta, and it'll stop us right there. We may get into chapter 28 some tonight too, but chapter 27 will get us the journey to there. And so in chapter 27 it begins, it says, "And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment." So here's Julius, he's in charge of Paul and these other prisoners. Presumably these other prisoners are also appealing to Caesar. This centurion's in charge of making sure that all of these guys make it to Rome to get their day in court. And it says, "So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia." Now, This is a ship of Adramyttia, an Adramyttian ship. That was not a Roman ship. And the reason it's not a Roman ship is Romans didn't have ships. The Roman government did not have a navy. They didn't believe in it. What they believed in is if we needed to go somewhere by boat, we have soldiers with swords. And they find a boat, and then they tell the people on the boat, take us where we want to go, or you will have to deal with this sword. And that's how they dealt with things. So they had kind of a very simple system as far as they were concerned. You can walk up to a boat and you say, where are you going? And if you are going anywhere the direction we're going, you're taking us. And consider it your donation to Caesar's funds. And that was just how they worked. And so here, the centurion, he's in charge. They find this ship, the Adramyttian ship, that was headed the direction that they were planning on going, probably carrying plenty of goods and whatnot, and they're just going to board that ship. We'll find out, there will actually be two different ships that Paul will be on here before he gets to Island of Malta, both commandeered the same way as centurion, and it'll be interesting. You'll see how much authority that the Romans had when they have to make a seagoing decision. Do we sail or not? Do we find harbor or not? They would actually ask the centurion what he wanted to do, because even the owner of the ship was not in charge of where the ship went and what they were going to do. That centurion, Julius, he's in charge of the whole deal. So not a seafaring man himself, but he had all the authority of the ship. So this ship was a larger ship. We're going to actually find that this ship, it doesn't tell us how many people were on it, but the next one, it'll tell us that there were 276 people on board. So when you look at that picture, you know, kind of have to scale it in your mind as a pretty big rig that they were on. These were some of the largest ships at sea, and they were meant for carrying goods like wheat and grain of various sorts and large loads from Egypt and whatnot up to Rome and other areas. So they get on this boat, and it says, Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. Now, pause there real quick and just remember the training we've gone through as we go through Acts of training of the language. When the writing says, Aristarchus went with us, what does that tell you? Paul's there and somebody else. Us includes Luke, doesn't it? That always includes Luke. So that's the way he would write. So Paul is traveling here as a prisoner, but he's got his buddies with you, which that's why I tell you he's kind of in a different category, isn't he? If a prisoner today was being transported from one place to another and he said, hey, could I have some of my friends come along on the prison bus? They're not going to say yes. But they did with Paul because he was in kind of a different category. He was given a lot of leeway and privileges. And so it says, he was with us, and from Caesarea, the next day we landed at Sidon. So Sidon, you just move up just a little bit there along the coast. They're going to travel along the coast for the most part. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. One commentator made the point that Paul receiving care, it's quite possible that the care was just good old-fashioned seasickness and things like that. I mean, this traveling on, it's not a cruise ship. These people traveling on these ships, it was hard. You think about it, even when I say there's 276 people on the ship, they're not all in their own comfortable quarters where everything's nice and you know, you have your own towels and toiletries and various things. This is cramped quarters. It's very uncomfortable. And so it would be very normal. You get to port and everybody wants off the boat. But if you're a prisoner, you don't get that right. Except Paul did. So Paul was given the liberty, that privilege, to go to his friends, receive care from his friends. And then it says, when we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. So under the shelter of Cyprus means that we kind of went through this area here and traveled that way, because we're already beginning to hear that there are troubles with the weather, and that's going to be a major problem for Paul and this ship as they go. It says, and when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia, And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. So now we have a ship change. Basically, we're just hopping ships. That's all we're going to do. The Romans, hey, where are you going? You're kind of going where we want to go, so you're going to take us. And then they get somewhere else. Oh, you're a better route. And that Alexandrian ship would look very similar to the one that I showed you before. It's the same kind of design. But we'll find that it was heavily laden down. It was carrying a lot of grain and product and things like that. And so they're in the business of making a profit. And so they want to get to their destination. And so as Paul and company go on board, they're still traveling to take care of trade. This isn't just the centurion and the prisoners on there. And so, now verse 7, when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmon. Now, here's Cnidus, and what we find is it was taking a long time to travel because they're going against the wind. They don't have the wind at their backs. They're having to tack back and forth to get the ship where they want, and there's the constant fear. As they're going along the coast, the last thing you want is to end up out here. Or, as we'll see later, where they do end up, out here. You don't want to be out in that open space with that contrary weather. The coast, you're hugging that coast as closely as you can to protect yourselves and protect the ship. And so as they're traveling, they have to always be monitoring the sails so that they don't get caught up in the wind and end up right out in the middle of nowhere and with problems. And so they travel at a very slow rate. They sailed under that shelter of Crete, then off of Crete, off Salmon. And passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. So what we find is here they're traveling, and it's getting harder and harder to get where they want to go. Now, if you are the captain and the owner of the ship and the sailors on the ship, you want to progress for one specific reason. Money. If nothing else, you want to progress for money. Because if your ship takes longer to get there to trade your product, you make less money. That's all it comes down to. It's just like today you compare the oil tankers that are out there, the giant oil tankers. I've read places that they have those. They try and get them dialed down as close as they can to travel at as fast as they can to get that oil from one place to another, because every minute is money. Because every minute traveling is a minute you're not picking up another load and doing it all over again. So these guys really want to progress, but they're not progressing. They're not getting very far at all. And it says in verse 9, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives." Now, Paul is a man who is familiar with ships. Paul will later on talk about that he was shipwrecked multiple times. We only read about one shipwreck, but he was shipwrecked multiple times. So Paul knows what it's like when the weather's bad and you could end up in trouble. So Paul advises them and says, "No, I don't think we can go anywhere. I think we've got to hold it here, guys." And he just really, there's no divine revelation from God in this. This is just Paul saying, I'm looking at the weather. I'm seeing how things are progressing. I'm seeing that the time of the fast is over. That is, that's really the date of that is about October, our October. So we're getting into the winter months. We've got to stop. We've got to stop this boat, or we're not only going to lose the cargo, we're going to lose the ship, and we're going to lose our lives. And so Paul is really advising them and pleading with them to stay put. And then it says in verse 11, "Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the thing spoken by Paul." So Paul says, no, let's stop. But the owner of the ship and the helmsman, the guy guiding the ship, they say, no, we can keep going. And they're all arguing their point before who? If you look there in the verse, who's the guy who's going to make the final decision? It's the centurion. That's how much authority he had. This is my ship. When the Roman soldiers took over a ship, it was their ship. And so ultimately, the centurion is not persuaded by Paul. He's persuaded by the owner and the helmsman, which you can kind of see why that might be, right? I mean, it's not illogical of the man to listen to the guy who owns the boat before listening to Paul. But having said that, Paul is going to end up being right. Paul has a more cautious approach to this than these other guys did. And so it says down verse 12, because the harbor was not suitable to winter, and the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete open toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. And so their goal was to make it a little farther along the island, make it to a harbor, a better harboring location than where they were at there at Fair Havens. And then they would winter there. And so when the south wind blew softly, supposing they obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete. Now, when it talks about that idea of having, supposing they had obtained their desire, that's like saying, we've made it, guys. They saw the weather, it all seemed great, and they said, let's get going. This will be perfect. We're almost there. But that weather turns. And one of the things that they say, those who, you read books, I'm not a sailing type, but I read, and the people who are, they say that this neck of the woods, it can turn just like that, and more so than even really the open water. It's kind of like lakes, the Great Lakes. The weather can turn just like that, and there's quite a lot of shipwrecks because of that. Well, that's what's going to happen here. Not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euryclidon. Some of your versions will call it a nor'easter, because that's really what Euryclidon means. It's a wind coming from the northeast, and it was coming down, and it's going to drive that ship. And so when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. So here, the wind is coming up off the island here, and it starts coming from this northeast direction, driving down, and that's exactly where they don't want to go, because that wind's going to drive them right down into this area here, which is that open water we want to stay away from. They want to stay close to the coast there. And eventually, though, the wind becomes so strong, they can't do anything. They can't fight it anymore. If you continue to fight it, it's going to tear the ship apart, capsize you. So they let it drive, meaning they just give up and let the wind take them where they're going to take them. There comes a point where that's the smartest thing you can do, is instead of fighting that wind, you just let it drive and hope that you can ride it out. And so that's what we're doing now. We're no longer sailing in the common sense of it. What we're doing at this point is we're just trying to survive the storm. So running under the shelter of an island called Clauda. Now Clauda is there, and you see that dot for Clauda? That dot's the size of the island. So they're riding under Clauda there. They're able to secure the skiff, which tells you, remember when I said supposing they'd obtained their desire? You know, they had the small skiff, the boat that hangs off the side. They had that thing ready to go. They had it all set up. So, boy, we're going to make it over here. We're going to make it to this better harbor. We'll drop the boat. We'll get in there. It'll all be set to go. And then that wind hit, and the skiff isn't even secured. So that's how confident they were that they were going to be okay. And then, of course, they weren't. And so under the shelter of that island, they get just enough security that they can secure that skiff with difficulty. And when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. And fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. That undergirding of the cables, what they do is they take ropes and they would put them and wrap them under the bottom of the boat so that they... and they would tie it up at the top. And basically you did that to make sure that the boat stayed together. That's all you're really trying to do. It's a duct tape issue is what you're doing. You're duct tape and baling wiring that ship together so that as it's tossed about by the wind and the waves, all that ship will stay together instead of all the boards popping apart and there being so much twisting that the boat starts leaking and things like that. So they're now preparing for a worst case scenario. And that's what we need to understand this is that this is a very scary time. They've given up on sailing, and now it's about surviving. So they've undergirded that ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Sirtis sands, they struck sail, and so were driven. I actually have a picture I'll show you later of the sands underneath this region of the Mediterranean. But the Sirtis sands think of like sand dunes. You know, like you go out to Arabia and you see those sand dunes. But imagine them under the water. And you know how sand dunes, they'll move all the time? Well, instead of it being the wind that moves the Arabian desert sand dunes, it's the water that moves them. But these giant dunes under the water, they move all over the place. So you can't map them. You don't know where it is. But you can be miles away from the coast and have your ship be grounded. Which is a really big problem. Because if you have a giant ship and all of a sudden it's grounded on one of these sand dunes, underground sand dunes, that would come up and create a situation of shallow water, there's nothing you can do. You're going to die. That's all that's going to happen. You're just going to die out there. And so they're very nervous of it. And even to this day, people are nervous of the Sirtis sands. And so all of those happen, by the way. Those are right in this region where they're at right now. And so down in verse 18, it says, "And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. So now we begin throwing things off. And on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands." Now the tackle, that's the stuff you use to repair the boat, to control the boat, it's all of the rigging and things like that, those things that you would use to run a ship. It's the guts, it's the innards, it's the beating heart of the ship, I guess you could say. And they've just thrown that all overboard. Now we'll find that they still have some simple ways of controlling the ship, but they've given up major control of it. And you only do that, it's the same today. What would it take for you to all of a sudden say, you know, you're on an airplane and they say, okay, let's just start throwing the seats out of the airplane. We got to lighten the airplane, throw the seats out. What sort of a situation would you have to be in to begin thinking that way? That's what they're doing on this boat. They're that concerned. Life, this is life or death. And each day is getting particularly worse. And then we find out in verse 20, after they've thrown that tackle over, it says, "When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us." Now that's the way Greeks talk, no small. We would say a really big tempest beat on us. All hope that we would be saved was finally given up. So they haven't seen the sun. They haven't seen the stars for many days. And we're going to find out they're out there 2 weeks. If you can't see the sun and you can't see the stars, and you don't have a GPS, you're lost. And that was their situation. They have no control over the ship, and they don't know where they are. And it's so dark that you can't figure out to navigate one way or another. So they're just out here in this open sea, and it's total chaos, and the tempest is beating on them, is the language that it used. And all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Everybody has just now reached that point that we are going to die out here. And there's a mindset change that begins to happen when you give up hope. And so down in verse 21, it says, "After long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss.' And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. Now, this is, I always have thought of verse 21 as being kind of unlike Paul. This isn't the way Paul normally talks. It sounds an awful lot like an I told you so, doesn't it? And really, it is. It is an I told you so, but he's doing it for a purpose. Last time Paul gave his advice on something, they didn't listen to him, did they? They listened to the owner of the ship and the helmsman. This time, he really wants them to take his advice. And he can't say, well, take my advice because I'm an apostle, because that's not going to work with them because they're not Christians. They could care less about that sort of thing. So he's appealing to what they do know, which is, do you remember back when we were having this debate over whether we should sail? Who was the one guy who said, don't do it? That was me. Now I've got some things I'd like to talk to you about. So there really is a purpose to it, in that he's hoping that they'll listen to a man that they normally wouldn't listen to. After all, what is Paul? Where's his rank in this journey? Who is he? He's a prisoner. He's a nobody. So why listen to him? He said, listen to me, because I was the guy, if you'd listened to last time, we wouldn't have been here. So I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. So Paul's about to tell them about a revelation that he had received that night from God. Now, why doesn't he just say, there stood by me this night an angel from God? Why does he say an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve? Why would he have to say that? They don't. There's a lot of different gods. That's exactly it. Now, I want to tell you about the one God that I belong to and I serve. He sent me a messenger this last night saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. Now, before we go any farther, the angel told him, do not be afraid, Paul. What does that tell you? What was Paul? You don't tell somebody don't be something unless they are, right? Paul's afraid too. Paul, when it says, you go up in verse 20 where it says, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up, Paul would be lumped up into that group, wouldn't he? We all gave up. We had all given up. This goes to show you some of the humanity of the, you know, the men that you and I read about, these great Bible heroes. Hadn't God already told Paul he was going to make it to Rome? God had already said that, hadn't he? Multiple times. And yet here is Paul, and he's on this boat, and he gives all hope up of being saved. Well, why? Can't he put two and two together? Well, there's only one reason, as far as I can tell. Paul's a human being just like you and I. And there is a point where the fact you haven't seen the sun, you haven't seen the stars, you don't know where you are, we've thrown the ship's tackle over, all the evidence points towards we're never going to survive this, and it affects you. So, you know, the next time you struggle with something, God says this, but then you struggle to accept it, understand you're not the first person, nor will you be the last person to do it, but the job that we have set before us by God is to struggle with that doubt. Don't just give in to it, struggle with it. And so here Paul's told, don't be afraid. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Now, in verse 24, another thing to point out here, because this, I mean, whenever you have a message directly from God, it's worth noting the specifics here, right? When we finish the book of Acts, a spoiler alert, Paul, you never read in the book of Acts about Paul standing before Caesar. It never gets to that part. You never hear about that trial. You never see him standing before Nero or any of those things. You don't get to read about that. That's all left in the future. So how do you and I know that Paul actually stood before Caesar at some point? This would be a good place to find it, wouldn't it? Because what did God just tell Paul? You will be brought before Caesar. So even though we won't read it in the book of Acts, he's going to be brought before Caesar. That's part of the journey that's going to happen. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So now, here, when it says God has granted you, if I went up to one of my children and I said, I have granted you that cookie, what do you know happened before that statement? What did that kid do to me? If I say, I've granted you that cookie. At some point they asked for the cookie, didn't they? They wanted the cookie. Here, God has granted you, Paul. He's given to you. He granted it to you. That thing you requested. All those who are sailing with you. So we find out something else in here. What's Paul been doing this whole time when all hope's been lost, the tackle's been thrown over, they don't know where they are? He's been praying. Paul's been praying, and not just for himself. He's been praying for all those on board. Now, were all the people on board Christians? No. So we have an example here, an apostolic example, approved by God, because God's going to give him a yes to it, of praying for people who are outside of Christ, that they would have good things happen to them. So this would be one of several places you could go to in your Bible to see the idea that it is a positive thing for Christians to pray for those who are outside of Christ, and not just pray that they become Christians, but pray also for their lives to turn out well. And so here was Paul praying that God would save him and all those on board, and the angel says, God has heard your prayer and he's granted you your life as well as the life of those who are sailing with you. So then he says, verse 25, therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. That's a big statement. You can preach a whole lot of sermons on that alone. I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. That is exactly what we're called to do as Christians, isn't it? God says it, we believe it, and live like it's already happened. That's what we've got to do. And if we don't do that, we're not living in faith. So Paul says, I believe God that it's going to happen just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. So this is where we're going to eventually end up, on that island of Malta. Then verse 27 says, when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. How they sensed it, the Bible doesn't tell us specifically. Sailors sensed things multiple ways. They might have heard the beating of the water against the rocks. You can smell a difference when you get close to land. Sailors have been known to have an acute sense of smell for a very long time, and that there's a difference between land smell and sea smell, and it might have been that. Don't know for sure, but there, in whatever way, these sailors, they note, we're getting close to some land. And they took soundings, that is, they took some measurements of the depth of the water. And they found it to be 20 fathoms, and when they had gone a little further, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. So, they're measuring the depth of the water, and it goes from 20 to 15. Now, even if you don't know what a fathom is, what do you know is happening to the depth of the water? It's getting more shallow. And so, we're getting closer and closer to land. And so then, fearing lest we should run around on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So they are going to drop these anchors to slow them down and in hopes that the sun will come out, they can see what they're doing, figure it out before they get to land. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea, under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, that is, from the front, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Now, the sailors are able to pull the wool over the eyes of a lot of the people there, but Paul has enough experience with ships to see that what they're doing is not making sense, and they're just planning to escape. And so he warns the centurion. He says, you got to get these guys to stay on the ship. So the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. Well, that solved the problem. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day you have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. So they have now gone 2 weeks with either total or close to total abstinence from food. They're just a beaten down group of people. And that's what happens during times of trauma. It's not like they purposely chose to fast, but You know, I'm sure there were people who were seasick. I'm sure that there were people who were just anxious, didn't feel like eating, any number of things. But basically, they, for whatever reasons, they've not been keeping their strengths up. And after all, it did say they gave up all hope. And when you don't have a lot of hope, you don't really think about eating for tomorrow. And so it says down that Paul implored them, therefore, in verse 34, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Now, what is interesting is you see, in all of this chaos, as you have the sailors trying to escape to save their own lives, people huddling and the almost 300 of them worried and having lost hope and scary, in the dark, all these various things, there's one guy who seems to have his act together, and it's Paul. And so Paul, in this time of great trauma and crisis, jumps to the forefront as a leader by default. Because in times of trauma and crisis, when you look around and everybody's running around like chickens with their head cut off, and there's one person who has their mind in order and says, I need you to do this, they immediately become the leader, don't they? That's just how it happens. And so that's what Paul has done. He's moved from the prisoner to the leader. And look at what he does with that leadership. He gets them to calm down. He gets them to eat. And then when he takes bread, what does he do? He gives thanks to God in the presence of all of them. So here he prays and gives God thanks for the food. In the middle of all this chaos, he doesn't forget to do that. And he does it in front of all of these pagans. Now, we talk a lot about being the kind of people that let our light shine. This is a prime example of it. That when things got difficult, he didn't forget who he was when everybody else was forgetting who they were. Right? I mean, you have these sailors who in normal circumstances probably were fairly fine gentlemen, or at least normal, and didn't wake up in the morning thinking, we'll murder a whole bunch of people. But what had they just done? Run like rats for the boat and said, we're going to get out of here and leave all the rest of them to die. That's what happens to people in times of great struggle. And Paul didn't do that. And so he's going to stand out because of that. And there's a lesson there to us about the kind of people we should be when things are difficult. That's so often the things that God asks us to do are so counterintuitive. They're so different than what everybody else would naturally do. Love your enemies. What does everybody else do when you've got an enemy and nobody blames you for it? You get angry and you yell and you scream or you hate them or whatever it is. There's bitterness. That's a normal thing. Nobody blames you for feeling that way towards your enemy. But when you do something different, you stand out. Nobody blames you for running around like a chicken with your head cut off in the middle of a crisis. That's what people do. But when you don't, you stand out. And so these are things for us as Christians. In times when all hope is lost, the last thing that anybody expects you to do is to be grateful and to give thanks. And yet when you do, it makes you stand out. Paul's doing these sorts of things, and it's really to the glory of God. It says, then they were all encouraged, and they also took food themselves. You notice here Paul's praying and giving thanks to God. His example, what did it do to all those people? Even the pagans, they were encouraged. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. And when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, that is, in this case, when you think of two seas, I don't want you to think of two oceans, it's two waves, where two, you know, you see the waves coming in and they're meeting right here, and the ship gets stuck right between the two. The ship ran aground and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So here the boat, instead of being able to move naturally with the waves, now the front of it stuck. And the back of it's just getting beaten by and hammered by these two waves. And so now it's time to get off the boat. Because after all, Paul said, everybody's life's going to be saved, but you're going to lose the ship. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. So the sailors were willing to let everybody die, and now it's the soldiers' turn to let everybody die, at least the prisoners. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship, and so it was that they all escaped safely to the land. So here it is. Because of Paul, centurion, he wanted to save Paul, all the other prisoners were saved. So you just see how much good came from Paul's example in all of this. I mean, you just begin to lay it out. And it's none of the things that he's done have been big things. They've all been little acts of faithfulness and trust in God. Things like giving thanks before a meal. Things like not worrying and trusting in God. Things like praying. Not things that we would think of as gigantic acts of heroism. And yet, they end up doing a great deal of good. And we need to remember that ourselves. Now, does anybody have any comments or questions there on chapter 27? Okay, well then just a few things here as we kind of finish up the class. This is Malta. And this is actually called Paul's Bay in Malta because they think this is the most likely bay that he landed. And you can see there, you know, I mean, I can't tell you where he was. But if this is the bay, you can see where it, you know, you got some harsh waves in there. And a ship gets stuck, it start to tear that ship apart. Now, I'm going to do something I never thought I would do, which is I'm going to throw a picture of the Pope up here. And I had no choice. The guy photobombed what I cared about, which is, this is called, and it's named after him too, it's called Benedict's Anchor. And the one thing that is kind of nice is him being there, you can see some scale to the thing. This is a lead anchor from an Alexandrian ship from the time period that Paul's shipwreck happened, and it was found off the coast of Malta. Now, if you ask me, is this one of those four anchors that they dropped? I can't tell you, but they would look like that, which is kind of cool. So when it talks about they got close, and where is it? Down in verse 40, they let go of the anchors and left them in the sea. It is possible that that's one of them, and if that's not one of them, that's what they look like. So just kind of an interesting aside there. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay. Then here, this is the other picture I've got. This is called the Sirte Reis. And this is a map. If you took the water away and you just looked at the ocean floor, and you can kind of see in here through this section these ripples, these dunes, that's the Sirte sands that they were worried about that would move around. And so you could never map them. You didn't know where they'd be. But if you landed on one of them, it was literally like being stranded on an island right out in the middle of nowhere, and you were going to die. And so they were very, very nervous about landing on those sand at that time. With that, we'll stop there. We'll end at the end of chapter 27. Anybody have any questions or anything like that? Yes, sir.
Did their ships have four anchors?
Four anchors, yeah. Yeah, so and so that would have been one of them. I mean, you look at it, it's a big dude, and it's lead. So it's heavy. I mean, I would struggle maybe a little bit. I could probably pick it up, no problem, but I'd struggle a little. Anybody else? Okay. Perfect. Then we'll close down there and pick up in chapter 28 next week.